like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it!
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course, that's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course, we want to play at the weekend.
Hello, you are welcome along to Golf Weekly. It is a Thursday afternoon here in Dublin, Ireland. The sunshine is out. It's finally happened. May is here. We're all feeling high on vitamin D. We are here, as ever, with thanks to the Dubai Duty Free Irish Open. Great supporters of golf and great supporters of this podcast. The Irish Open obviously will include McIlroy, Lowry, Harrington, Justin Rose and plenty more at the brilliant Port Stewart Golf Club, July 6th, 7th, 8th and 9th. And we strongly recommend you make it your business to go there because it should be really, really good. And the weather hopefully will oblige. DubaiDutyFreeIrishOpen.com/tickets is where you can find more information. Fionn Davenport is here. Hello.
Hey, Joe.
And Dave McIntyre is here.
Gentlemen.
Nathan Murphy down in Galway at a conference of some sort.
Yes, some mobile media conference. I'm always Fionn standing, so it's nice to actually be on the pod with Fionn.
It's good. I was thinking the exact same thing. Good to see you, Dave.
Yeah
it's amazing it's to see you two together.
Yeah, indeed.
Two handsome men.
Oh, absolutely.
You know.
Getting so, better with age, Fionn.
We have a good podcast for you today because Brandel Chamblee, who we have a major man crush on, is on the pod. He's written a new book, The Anatomy of Greatness, Lessons from the Greatest Swings in Golf. And we have invited him on to talk about it. And he agreed. Was really, really good with his time. Fionn and I spoke to him earlier on. He was really good. So we'll bring you that. And Chamblee's obviously just an excellent commentator on the game of golf.
And all this on the back of the in-depth discussion we had on man crushes on last week's pod.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, so Brandel Chamblee, excellent. Someone there tweeted me when I said the great Brandel Chamblee's on later saying you overused the word great. And I don't know if that's true or not. But
as pundits go, he is great.
Yeah, it depends what you're referencing.
Well, I said in the golfing punditry landscape, for me it's Chamblee and Miller. I want to know what they think. Mm. And after that,
you would describe Fionn as a great bloke. I don't think that's overusing the word.
Stop. Nick Faldo
is right behind them.
Yeah. Also, Chamblee offers something different. He's not afraid, and he works really, really hard. His analysis is rooted in real research. He's just brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, he's one of those guys, and I'd liken him to maybe say Stuart Barnes on the rugby point of view, because people see him as being a dinosaur so far removed from the professional game. He works so hard to make sure he's relevant, that the golfing names that aren't big names, like Brandel Chamblee, who the vast majority of golfers would not pick out of a lineup if he walked into a room, they have to work extremely hard to prove their credibility. Mm. And it makes him brilliant.
Well, for his book, he went and essentially looked at all the great players and spotted commonalities in the great swings. And his big argument, which people I'm sure are aware of at this stage, is about the amount of lower body resistance in the modern day golf swing. Don't turn the hips at all. This separation of upper body and lower body, all nonsense, says Chamblee. All the greats lifted their left heel on the backswing. They turned their hips. Their right leg didn't stay braced. It straightened out. All of this stuff, the little turn of the head to the right before the swing, like Nicholas would do and Woods would do. These are all the things that he pinpoints as being really important. And his main issue with the resistance in the lower body in the modern swing primarily is, one, you have less time in the swing, so you need to be really explosive, and two, it causes back injury.
Is the tilt of the head to the right, is that the whole theory about keeping your head just slightly behind the ball at impact, so your head's not getting ahead of it?
I'd have to reread a lot of what he's written about it, but it's certainly something to do with how well you release the club as well.
Yeah.
And staying over the ball.
So, because your hands have to get ahead of your body to release rather than you dragging the club behind you.
Let's let Brandel handle all these questions.
Yeah. He's the expert.
So, Chamblee on the way, and your tweets are into @GolfWeeklyNT. Dodd O'Gorman was in touch. He was listening to the pod on a beautiful May evening on Ballybunion's 15th.
Oh, lovely. Which is sweet. Nice.
Yeah.
I hear.
I've never been to Ballybunion.
I've never played. I've been. It's gorgeous.
Mm. Yeah. Well, he was on the 15th. He said, hashtag friend of the pod, hashtag hard to concentrate with earphones. But we were there. Con Finnegan, what a day. Just played the old course.
Aye.
And after last week's pod, because we were talking about this, the 18th at the old course was voted Scotland's favourite golf hole. He said there was a strong wind. So the 18th, not just a drive and a flick of a wedge like I had said it was. He said it was with that wind, it was really tough.
Oh, yeah. But it is like it's a driving into, like you have 130 yards to aim at.
Yeah.
And then it can be anything from a 5-iron to a wedge. So,
John Hennessy had a video of, we're talking about the 13th at Druids Glen, because I was staying with Keevy at the hotel and the window overlooked the 13th, and I watched Golf Rapid.
The Scots the 13th? Is that the one with the...
It's the really narrow driving hole where you kind of have to hit a fade because the trees are coming out from the hotel, jutting out.
Yeah, sorry.
And you either have to hit the ball dead straight or use a power fade. Any kind of a slice or a hook or a draw, you're gone. And the great thing about the hole, as we were discussing last week, is that once you get to the landing area, you realise you've probably got the most difficult second shot in amateur golf in Ireland because the green is a mile away and it's almost an island green.
It's an island green with the water kind of separate.
Yeah.
Oh, it's
notoriously bad.
Well, I spent half an hour with my face against the glass watching amateur golfer after amateur golfer.
She's a lucky girl, Kiwi. Sounds like a great weekend away.
There's love is in the air.
She was getting ready, honestly. Instead of like committing to a straight drive away from all the danger, just try and play a little slider. Just try and sneak a few yards around that corner and come to grief doing so. And John Hennessy has a video, which I'll show you guys later, where effectively he says, "I'm blaming you for this shot in 13. Take it over the trees, you said," which was not what we said.
What?
I think, to be fair, he's being ironic because his shot goes about 15 feet and just goes way right. It's a complete
shot. Straight into the trees in front of him.
Everybody bursts out laughing.
Take it over the
trees.
It's
one of those great, great moments where he's obviously playing with a group comfortable enough to laugh at his awfulness.
You can take it around the trees. There's no chance of taking it over the trees.
If you have distance and you hit it dead straight, you'll go in the trees at
the
front.
That's the problem, yeah.
That's true.
For me, if I hit on that hole, if I drive it dead straight, I'll hit the fairway. But for anybody with any kind of length, straight into
the
trees.
You have to cut the ball.
Yeah. You do, but then you overcut it the ball bounces
into a slice.
Ronan, how Nathan came up with 11 million euro, I don't know. Much prefer Joe's outlook. Hashtag 500. Yeah, that was very strange. We were talking about how much money would you want to, how much money would do you for the rest of your life? And I said, I would want 500 million. Nathan said 11. So small minded of him.
He wants to buy a semi detached house somewhere and pay off his mortgage
and put the rest in bonds.
Well, no, he wants to, let's see, he's two kids, so he's figured the education's going to cost him, whatever, 20 grand. Yeah.
Joe was just being big time.
He is big time, though.
He could have had anything and he picked 11
million. He said 11 million. But he's trying not to be greedy.
Pathetic. Dave said 20, I think.
Did you say 20
20
million?
20 is a nice fat number.
Well, as I said last week, I wanted to get a billion, but I thought that would be gratuitous.
Can I mention too, I met a friend of the pod on Grafton Street yesterday. Yeah. Sean Clancy, who's a regular.
Oh, yeah.
I know he listens, he tweets.
Yeah.
Lovely, very nice fella.
Right.
Yeah. As are all our potters.
That's true.
He's, this guy, it was actually nice to have a conversation with a listener on the street just about life and everything. It was really good.
Oh, that's my nightmare.
Not about your life.
Yeah. Don't look at me.
You didn't even come up.
Actually, interestingly, I was saying this to Fiona earlier. I was doing a kind of corporate thing where people in the crowd had to write down questions for said sports person. And I would read the questions to him. And I was going through them and they have to write their name on it. And I got to one and it just said friend of the pod instead of a name. I like that. That was a classy touch. Ant was in touch to say, at 44 minutes 40 last week, I laughed so hard I almost drove off the road, boys. Don't know what that was about, but be careful. Pro V1 Kenobi back in touch. Great evening for a walk, listening to the pod. Nice picture of the nice weather.
Write down that time. We'll have to check that when we go back out. Yeah. When we leave the studio, figure out what it was.
They said that I said something and I went and listened and it was you.
Yeah.
I'm always trying to pass myself off as you.
Someone confused your voice with Dave's, which is a feat.
Yeah.
Conor Mangan, enjoyed listening to the pod before golf at Fairways and Blue Water in Boracay in the Philippines.
Oh, what a beautiful spot. Boracay is one of the islands of the Philippines. I've been to Manila and Boracay. And Boracay, I was there for 3 days and it's one of those places. And that's 10 years ago. I was going to say not a month goes by. Let's not exaggerate. Every 6 months or so, something comes up about the Philippines and I go into like a full 15-minute reverie about Boracay.
Right.
It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever been to. And midnight swims. Oh,
wow. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Met a beautiful girl.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. She was a travel agent from Northern Ireland.
Oh, wow.
Oh, listen.
What was her accent like?
It was... Yeah, Northern Irish.
Nice.
Very kind of
well-rounded.
Where is she now?
Real holiday romance.
She's married. And she's married with kids up in Banbridge or whatever.
So you've Facebook-stalked her.
Well, we became Facebook friends and we've remained Facebook friends even though we haven't literally contacted each other for about 6 years.
I'm not sure about that now. That slight bit of titillation just from seeing the odd post.
Sometimes, yeah. Ah, good old. I won't say her name because.
Don't.
No. But she was gorgeous and lovely and great fun. And it was, and in fact, that trip, yeah.
Good memories. He's amazing. Glowing here. Our listeners can't see it. He's glowing in his chair.
This is the benefit of having the travel writer back for the for the tweets, you know? Because the last couple of weeks you haven't been here, I've just been reading out tweets. Anyone been there? No.
All right.
Move on. Whereas.
Boracay.
Look what you brought to the party there with a mention of the Philippines.
Yeah, no one ever writes in from Ballyhonus Golf Clubs.
Nathan's
been there. Yeah, I've been there.
Donald McGrath, big fan and friend of the pod, just me. Is there always a big volume difference between Joe's dulcet tones and the other potters? Yeah, I do think I don't seem to be as loud. I've noticed that myself, so I've hopefully amended that this week. Kieran O'Dea, catching up on the podcast and then a great round at Luttrellstown, perfect venue for friends of the pod summer outing. Yeah, we've been spending some time at Luttrellstown lately.
We have indeed.
Fantastic. Amazing greens, very, very fast.
Wonderful golf course.
Yeah.
We shall be spending a lot more time there in the coming weeks
and
months.
That's the plan, yeah. Damien O'Brien, first mixed competition with the good lady wife in Al Zora, United Arab Emirates. It's good you can play with your wife, you know. I've often thought, would I want that?
It's got its pros and cons.
On the one hand, you're guaranteed to get out more often. But then the con might be, I don't know. Do you know, I don't know what the con would be.
Yeah, I'm not a big, I don't really hold to that. I use golf to get away from my significant other.
Yeah, I don't either. I like my significant other.
If you're only playing once a week, if you only have the time to play once a week, do you always want it to be with your wife / partner?
Mm. But that implies that your wife / partner insists on only playing with you. Like, if she's as keen on golf as you are, then the idea of playing together is great because then you'll play also with your mates, she'll play with her mates, and you know,
well, that's if you've got time in your hands to play a couple of rounds a week.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. I'd be more than happy for Kiwi to start playing golf.
Yeah, I want the same. Laura was a good junior apparently, but she won't.
I don't think I've any fear of Nikki ever picking up a golf club, but you know, stranger things have happened.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. Might be the only way for you to spend some time together.
She might end up playing more golf than I do, which wouldn't be too hard.
They are your pods. They are your tweets to the pod. Keep them coming at Golf Weekly NT. We're going to bring you Brandel Chambly in a few minutes' time, but first there's golf news to talk about. So, where do we start here? Let's touch on last week's Zurich
Classic.
Classic, yes. Zurich Classic. We were bigging up this last week and we were looking forward to it because there was a novelty aspect to the team event. The weather didn't help.
It was
very difficult on Sunday to find it or to get into it. And obviously it finished on the Monday. So I think a lot of people would have missed this. You saw a good bit of this?
I did see a good bit of it. I was actually in Portland over the weekend, so I was watching it just by pure fluke. I was sitting in the hotel. And it's always that thing when I'm in America where obviously, we watch US golf at night here. Yeah. So it's the middle of the day and I'm channel surfing and all of a sudden it comes on and it takes me a second to adjust to go, oh, no, this is when golf is actually played. The winner, Cameron Smith and Jonas Blixt, won on the Monday playoff. But they beat Kevin Kisner and Scott Brown. But the real moment, there was two standout moments, one in the kind of long-term health of golf and one in the immediacy of it was in regulation on the 18th, Kevin Kisner needed to chip in to force the playoff. Sure enough, from whatever it was, like 40 yards on the green, hits the flagstick, drops in.
Wow.
And it was unbelievable. It was so exciting to watch. And now, I couldn't care less about Kevin Kisner. I know he's a pretty decent player, but he's not one I particularly look for. But I was so, I jumped up and I was like, oh yes. And then they lost in the playoff the next day, which I didn't see. But it
so
really
come
is
back the next day for one hole.
Yeah. Well, no, they played. Did they play the 18th over? I can't remember. I didn't see it.
It was a one hole playoff.
Oh yeah, I just saw it in the paper that Smith and Jonas Blixt. But the talking point, well, other than the format, which some people loved, some people thought was garbage, and there was this sense of like, look, just because it's different doesn't mean it's something that should happen regularly. I mean, it's the PGA, but this is the first on-course slow play penalty leveraged by the PGA Tour in 22 years.
Yeah, you're going back to Glenn Day.
1995.
Known in the locker room, I read during the week as All Day.
That's right.
How long it took him to hit a golf shot back at the Honda Classic in 1995.
And so straight away, okay, so, you know, we talk about slow play all the time. It's the scourge of golf. You know, it's killing the game. And so on the surface, you're thinking, great, like finally, the PGA Tour is going to say, going to do something about it.
I should say the culprits were Miguel Angel Cabrero and Brian Campbell.
Well, actually, no, they weren't. Miguel Angel Carballo, again, player never heard of, and Brian Campbell, again, player never heard of. They were alternates. They didn't arrange to play together. They were forced into it because they were second last and last alternates, so they were just paired together.
Okay.
So they didn't know each other, like unlike the other pairings who would know they selected. So that's number one. So people were saying, already the dynamic is a bit different. You know, they don't know each other's games and so. So anyway, so he was like, it was Campbell was slow, but when one player is slow, the team is dinged. So you know the way slow play penalties work. Like that's why they never give one. So you're put on the clock. Okay, that's not considered one of the two. Then you're warned. And then you get the slow play. So every time you're warned, every player always speeds up, which is the reason why. But when you're in a team event, so one player gets warned and then the other player is slow. And so that's how the penalty was given.
So what was it, a one-stroke penalty?
Yeah, one-stroke penalty.
Now, again, it seems like the victims here were more vulnerable than your ordinary pro and that they were an easy target. I'm reminded of the Chinese kid that was penalised at Augusta National a couple of years ago. Like it was a teenager.
Yeah, what's his...
like they're not going to penalise Phil Mickelson for slow play.
Tian Langguan was the 14-year-old. No, but interestingly, Brian Harman, who is rated the 12th fastest player on the PGA Tour, he oared in with his opinion over the course of the week. And so he was saying is that he noticed that the Tour unfairly punishes players in the first few groups of the weekday rounds. And I didn't know this at all, but like based on your performances, you're given grouping. So generally the low qualifiers go out first on the Thursday and the Friday. And he was saying is that, and based on his own analysis, is that they're more put on the clock more often than players in the middle groups who are the winners and players in the later groups. And so he says that the PGA Tour, that there is a conscious or an unconscious bias, as you say, on players who are in the lower rungs who don't really, they don't carry the muscle.
Well, it's just human nature.
Yeah, you're not going to penalise. Yeah, you're not going to
every aspect of life. But so your point is that the format, the fact that Miguel Angel Carballo and Brian Campbell didn't know each other very well and that one was warned and the other didn't necessarily know? Is that like,
yes, exactly. That it was an easy penalty to levy.
I think, though, if they're putting the clock, they would both know. It's very strange.
No, no, sorry. Not that he didn't. They don't know each other's pace of play. Right. And so they don't have an easy relationship. So they didn't pair each other and say, look, I'm this kind of player and I dovetail well with you. They didn't necessarily dovetail well together. So anyway, they didn't say anything. People criticising the fact that there was an easy one, and is the PGA Tour then kind of saying, look, we're proactive about slow play, but when in fact they're really not, and it's going to be business as usual from henceforth on.
Maybe. I still think it's good. At least it's setting some kind of precedent. Maybe they felt, well, there hasn't been one of these since 1995. We're going to have to start somewhere. And at least, while it may be targeting easy targets, this does sound a bit of a klaxon that we're back doing this, you know, as opposed to, could you imagine in the final round of a big tournament hitting Phil Mickelson on the 12th and there hadn't been a penalty since 1995? That'd just be, you just couldn't do that. Whereas this almost gets the ball rolling slowly again. And so
soften the whole thing up.
If we have a penalty in 4, 5, 6 weeks, it's not like the victim can turn around and say, you haven't given one of these since 1995 and now you're hitting me. Yeah. So in that respect, I think it's to be applauded. I think it's about time they started handing them out, even if the first one is
you need
maybe
some consistency.
A little bit
unfair. They have a chance to be consistent on it now.
Yeah.
Really, there should be penalties being handed out left, right and centre at regular PGA Tour events.
Sure.
So I couldn't imagine these two, this pair were the only
guilty. The other extenuating circumstance is that because, you know, they're four balls and so they were paired with two section pros, like two guys who really struggled. Like they're not tour pros. So
four ball is the slowest format in the game.
By far.
So there's going to be that aspect. But can I just make a point though, because the wider context of Sunday night for a lot of people watching is that the Zurich Classic was delayed, weather delayed. So they took the WIMS event, the LPGA Texas Shootout, and that went to a playoff, and Christy Kerr in particular took an absolute hammering because it went to a playoff, and the playoff hole was this unbelievably difficult 18th where there was water and there were 40 mile an hour crosswinds. The ball was going towards the water a lot. They had to be very careful on the fairway. It was difficult to hold the green. They had to play the playoff hole six times. And man, it was slow. Like, Christy Kerr got absolutely destroyed on Twitter, to the point that she came out and apologised. She came out and said that, you know, conditions were very tough and it was tricky and the 18th hole is difficult. But man, like, how she's not given a penalty for slow play when you're watching it is just beyond belief. Yeah.
Well, they're never going to penalise someone in a playoff.
Exactly. And that's why hitting the two boys in the Zurich Classic at least softens it for when that is going to happen. But it's always exacerbated in a playoff because there's no other golf to go to.
That's it.
So yeah, they're just coming back to studio where they're trying to fill time ably.
There's a simple solution. Instead of putting them on the clock the first warning. And if you don't speed up, that's
it. So you're getting rid of one of the strikes.
Yes, you should. Absolutely.
Paul Lawrie was interested in this, speaking to Lawrence Donegan a while back, where he essentially said most players on tour have two pre-shot routines. One, their preferred one, and two, when they're on the clock. And that's just how it works.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah.
So they have their long one, the one that they enjoy the most, they're most comfortable with, and then they have a on-the-shot routine, which gets them out of being on the shot. And then he has said, in his experience, as soon as they're off the shot clock or whatever the phrase is, as soon as they're out of trouble, they go back to their old routine. Brilliant. And he's literally played with them, and he's almost looking across the fairway thinking, well, you... Why couldn't you just, like, you've done it. You've played beautifully the last four or five holes with a bit of speed, and now you're back to this old crack. Yeah.
Did you see Christy Kerr got into grief on Twitter? Did you see who else got into grief on Twitter this week? Dottie Pepper.
Oh, Dottie.
Yeah,
not Dottie. Like her.
She quit Twitter on the back of this. So she'd made a mistake. She'd asked Scott Brown, this is at the Zurich Classic, so she's interviewing him, and she says, oh, you know, you've never won or been in contention before. And then Brown kind of, very politely, he kind of go, oh, actually, I did win the Puerto Rico Open in 2013. And it was strange. Like, she doubled down, like, which is odd. Like, you'd think Dottie would just kind of go, oh, right, yeah. Instead, he'd also finished second at the Genesis Open. But instead, she kind of compounds the issue and goes, yeah, but you haven't contended in a full field regular event. And it was just like, come on.
Oh, Dottie,
just let it, please. Let it go. You made a mistake. So what? Big deal. Let it go. But so anyway, so she got absolutely hammered on Twitter, to the point that she quit with an announcement saying that she's not going to feed the trolls anymore. You know who else has, who's blocked up to 20,000 people on Twitter?
Current golfer?
Nope.
Current pundit?
Yeah.
Nick Faldo?
Nope.
Montgomery?
Are we to what? Give us a nationality.
We're going to go with our boy.
Chamblee?
Yep.
20,000?
Yeah.
Why didn't you say that before the interview?
Yeah.
20,000?
Yeah.
That's a lot of hate.
He said, this is his own words, he said he's blocked over 20,000 people on Twitter, quote, due to uncivil discourse and comments.
Well, listen, I don't have a problem with blocking. Do you block?
I block all the porn sites that are constantly trying to access my Twitter feed.
They work off your internet history, Dave. They do. They do.
Seriously.
That's a fairly standard algorithm.
You need to clean that internet cache. Like, what are you doing?
There's about three or four of those a day.
I told you about incognito window.
I'd say bar those types of followers or retweets, I maybe one.
Right.
I've never blocked anybody, but I mute people.
You need to be big time to get abuse. You probably get loads of it.
I do a bit.
There you go.
You need to, not because I'm big time, but because, like, for instance, you put out stuff to do with really the culture show, and people get very animated. And like even today, there was like a bit of trolling going on. But
really trolling?
Yeah.
But I get abuse after a commentary, but I wouldn't block them.
I mute them. I think it's just rather. I also think blocking, they know you're blocked, and then it kind of perpetuates the argument. You just mute them. They don't even know. They can shout away. I don't even hear a word of it. Who cares?
Yeah, fair enough. So
do you do that?
Block people? I've blocked plenty, yeah.
Okay.
See, Joe is big time.
You are big time.
Not big time, but I mute people that I follow and don't want to follow. there's people I'm obliged to follow that I just I feel obliged to follow. I just mute because I just I'll tell you later. Like, it's nothing personal.
Are those people in this room?
No. I love you two guys. Yeah. It's just like it just endless negativity out of these people.
Yeah.
Or else over-tweeting. Or else sharing too much of your family stuff. You know what I'm talking about there. No names.
So, I'm sure our listeners don't appreciate in-jokes, but That was one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll tell you about that one later. But it's one that just gets Joe's goat up with regularity.
If I ever get trolled, and it's happened maybe 5, 6, 7 times from different individuals, like in the last 5 years, which is not bad, just straight away, block. Yeah. It's a beautiful thing to do.
I was as part of the Crinew, and for non-Irish listeners, that there was all these talks on Easter Monday gone by. And so I was host of 4 different ones, and one of them was about homelessness. Another one was about the arts in Ireland, and then also had a really good interview with John Boyne, you know, the boy with the striped pajama, that author.
Yeah.
But then I had one on Islamophobia, on the growth of Islamophobia in Ireland. And once I tweeted that I was hosting this talk, oh my God.
Really?
Oh.
Dear, oh dear.
And it's just like, all right. Okay, and I appreciate that people can think what they want, but you know what? You have to bark it in my ear. Like,
so Dolly Pepper off Twitter.
She's off Twitter.
Okay.
And
life will be better for it.
It definitely will be better. I think though that the broader point is that, again, she would have been better advised to just be a little bit more humble. I mean, she is an outspoken critic. That's what makes her so good. And she certainly isn't afraid of expressing an opinion. But when a guy corrects you gently, because he wasn't bitchy, he just said, oh, actually, I did win.
And then you belittle the only tour win of his career.
Yeah.
Oh, it wasn't really a full field event.
And you're like, you know,
I'm
what,
sure
Dottie?
It felt like the pressure on him to get a maiden tour victory. I'm sure it felt like a full event.
Now, having said that, is like, unless she was trolled only by Scott Brown's friends or families, you got to figure, it's like, what are you getting, you know? Anyway, whatever. But
this,
that's that.
This week we have the Wells Fargo Championship, which is a brilliant tournament. There's generally an excellent finish here. You think, like, Rory's won here twice, his first win in 2010, and then a couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago now, where it was him and Fowler down the stretch, and McIlroy came out on top, and then Fowler's won here as well.
It's a different course though, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh no, is it?
It's no longer Eagle Quail Hollow.
Just for this year.
Just for this year,
because Quail Hollow's hosting the PGA Championship.
Oh, there you go.
Of course.
Is that incredible? What was it? A 62 he shot, McIlroy,
on the Sunday.
Something like that. Just blitzed past Mickelson. McIlroy finished several holes in front of everybody else.
I do love the 18th with the creek all the way down the left hand side. So, do we know anything about this new course?
Yeah, it's in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Right.
I mean, it's still, you know, Quail Hollow's in Charlotte, but so it's moved to Eagle Point. Now, maybe it's because it's not a Quail Hollow, but it's only got 7 of the world's top 30 in the field, which is quite limited compared to previous years, where it's one of the standout events on the tour.
The betting is Dustin Johnson, who we'll talk about in a moment, is back and favoured 11-4. Francesco Molinari is second in the betting. And then you're into John Rahm. Molinari must have started well if he's that high up in the betting. John Rahm is there at 12s. Rumoured to be coming to the Irish Open, though unconfirmed, very much unconfirmed. Webb Simpson is there at 18s. Alexander Noren, Paul Casey, 20s. Adam Scott, 22s. Yeah. Phil Mickelson is there at 30-1, as is Patrick Reed. So it's not unwatchable by any means. Zach Johnson is there at 40s, and I'm going down the list. Graham McDowell is playing, 66-1.
Shane Lowry in the field as well.
He's back in the
field. I would imagine that
Shane Lowry's busy over the next number of weeks, playing a lot.
If Phil's at 30s, he must already be on the course as we're recording and lobbing in a couple of bogeys there.
Jim Furyk's playing. Let's hope Shane Lowry goes well, because he needs to kind of recapture some of that form. McDowell, by all accounts, is hitting the ball quite well. He's made some swing changes. So that's our Wells Fargo Championship field. Dustin Johnson back, said he's practiced very, very little. The thing, his back took much longer than he had thought it would take to get better. You know, he's asked about how difficult it was missing the Masters. He says, the only time it was maybe tough was just watching the tournament. But after Sunday, it's been fine.
It's the most DJ answer.
I know. Like, immediately forgotten on Monday morning. What was yesterday? He was asked.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah. He was. He said he sent Sergio Garcia a text. And someone quickly said, was it to ask him if he got off easy? And Johnson said, exactly. Smiled. So
nice.
He's back. He's not overly confident of winning this week. He hasn't practiced very much, but at least he's back.
If he wins, it'll be the longest winning streak on the PGA Tour since
4
Tiger.
Wins?
Yeah.
Oh, since Tiger. Since Tiger.
6 straight in 2007 and 2008.
From Tiger.
6 straight.
Unbelievable.
That was back at the talk at the time, was will he go through the season unbeaten?
Isn't that unbelievable? I know. Didn't he have like a 50% win rate? Or thereabouts for like a long stretch, yeah.
Yeah, incredible.
Well, that's going on in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Wilmington. We have the Golf Sixes on
The
European Tour. So 16 teams of 2. They face each other over six hole stretches for the biggest chunk of a 1 million euro prize pool. Every player guaranteed 15,000 euro for turning up. There's going to be things like shot clocks, fireworks, music on the tee, mid-hole interviews, all of this kind of stuff to sex it right up. And Sky Sports are having celebrity commentators such as Vernon Kay and Kevin Peterson.
I mean, I hate it already.
Well, Ewan Murray writes that the additions of celebrity in The Guardian commentators such as Vernon Kay and Kevin Peterson is an attempt to attract a wider core audience, but it's woefully transparent. In fact, it is naff.
Well, is it a bit IPL, isn't it? It's like an equivalent of what they did with the IPL. And
but isn't it, I mean, the amazing thing about...
Sorry, that's the Indian Premier League for anyone who doesn't know cricket.
Well, I was going to say, the amazing thing about what they've done with cricket and snooker is it's kind of worked, and darts, it's kind of worked. You know, these sports that were very popular in across the latter period of the 20th century, and then attention spans and lifestyles changed. And like, it's worked for all those sports. So like, you have to commend the European Tour for trying. It's almost...
I think it's unfair of you and Murray to describe it in those terms. These guys are making a serious effort.
Yeah.
Like the tournament we saw down in Perth in Australia a few weeks back, like what the PGA Tour are doing with the Zurich Classic. They're not just letting it slide almost into oblivion over the next 15, 20 years. They know that there are changes to be made if they're going to generate the interest of the younger viewer.
Yeah.
And they're coming up with ideas. Not every idea is a good one, but you don't really know unless you put it into action. And we'll see.
Who's to say if things... like, well, Peter Lawrie was in here in studio last year talking about, you know, he was arguing with the European Tour. He was on the committee, obviously, saying we should have mid-hole interviews. You should be able to walk down the fairway and interview a golfer. Like, we need to make this stuff happen. Otherwise,
a good point.
At times the coverage can just
and in fairness,
just drag.
You cannot say that Keith Pelly hasn't devoted every ounce of his energy to reinvigorating a tour and to coming up with ideas. You know, maybe this will be a success, maybe it won't, but it does. Like I say, I hate it already, but I'm being tongue-in-cheek. The point is that whether it works or not is irrelevant. Trying it is important.
Mm.
And so, like, for instance, going back to the earlier point about slow play, they're introducing a shot clock. So anyone who fails to hit within 40 seconds automatically gets a one-stroke penalty.
That's going to be kind of cool.
I think that's going to be brilliant.
Yeah.
It's also greensome. So that's the format. So you pick your best tee ball and play alternate shot from there. So everybody drives.
Right.
Yeah, pick your best tee ball.
It's
and then,
like we're playing in a similar format tomorrow.
Oh,
like,
is that the format?
Yeah.
Oh,
you guys, champagne scramble, champagne I think scramble. Is the official term.
But, you know, like again, who's to say that this won't attract a ton of 15-year-olds? Much cooler, six-hole stretch, shot clocks. Like it means you might, like I would think you'd be far more inclined. Sometimes so we flick on golf on a Thursday or Friday. We're off in the mornings with this job. And I presume it's true for a lot of people on a Saturday or a Sunday. You flick it on sometimes and you've got an hour, 45 minutes to watch it. And quite often on a Thursday or Friday morning, you watch the golf for an hour, you can get very little out of it.
Yeah.
Whereas now imagine you're watching a six-hole stretch, shot clocks, the format we've just discussed. Okay, the music is not going to do much for me, but mid-hole interviews, suddenly that hour of watching golf is far more interesting. You get a lot more out of it. We're never going to a point where the majors or the bigger tournaments are changed. This is about the nothing weeks.
You've got longest drives, closest to the pin competitions.
Yeah.
The other thing is, will you rest until you see like this, golf sixes, where the players come out.
Well, they've tried that with snooker and didn't go down well.
There is entrance music now.
Oh.
Not that tune. They were blasting music at the Ryder Cup.
Yeah. It was amazing.
It was good fun.
And then, and you had Bubba whipping up the crowd. He wanted it at its height as he was hitting his
tee shot. That's one of my favourite moments ever I've witnessed in live golf.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with any of this.
No. I'm all for this.
And for though the naysayers for the format at the Zurich Classic in New Orleans, it only needs to be once a season.
Yeah.
But no one needs to fear that this is going to be a regular occurrence.
I take back that I hated it. I absolutely love everything about this.
There you go.
Okay, well,
didn't take long to convert him to
say we are sponsored by the European Tour. And
quite weak-minded.
No, only a fool never changes his mind.
That's a good point. Mm. Yes, we are here, of course, as usual, with thanks to our friends and good sponsors, the Dubai Duty Free Irish Open, which is suddenly on the horizon now, very much so. First week of July.
Yeah.
And we're looking forward to that week. We'll all be heading up in one form or another. So is there anything else anyone wants to mention before we get to Chamblee and we're tight for time here?
Yeah, I read a quick piece on Hunter Mahan.
God.
I know.
Hunter Mahan.
A man.
Do you know what's terrible? first thing I thought of was his chip at the Ryder Cup. But anyway.
That's
harsh. God, go on.
That's terrible.
So the reason why there was a tiny little piece written about him is that this time last year at the Wells Fargo Championship, he tied for 53rd, which is the last world ranking point he has earned.
Wow.
What's happened?
This is a guy who's won 6 times yeah. on the tour. He's gotten to number 4 in the world. Like, this is not a gopher player. Golfer. This yeah. is a serious player.
Won the Bridgestone Invitational in Akron.
Yeah, 6 times. So he's now 697th in the world. He's played 22 tournaments since last year, made only 5 cuts, but didn't finish high enough to earn any ranking points in any of them. So he's playing this season
yeah.
under a multiple victory exemption that he earned in 2012, 2014. Otherwise,
so what happened to this game?
It's,
what does the piece say?
That's it. No, nothing. There is absolutely no clue as to, I mean, clearly his game has completely yeah. deserted him. But
we don't know if it's driving, chipping.
We have no idea. I mean, his performance at the Ryder Cup was poor lad.
Yeah, but I mean, there's
extenuating circumstances.
There's duffing the odd chip, and there's,
that's 7 years ago,
disappearing off the face of the planet.
Yeah, but anyway, but he's literally disappeared. And I saw his name, and I was struck one thing, and I'm like, oh, Hunter Mahan, there is like one of the notable names yeah. that you see on in the field. And then I'm reading, I'm going, oh, no wonder I haven't heard from him yeah. in a year.
Yeah, God. Let's hope he gets it back. We'll might do a bit of digging and mention
and
next,
find out why.
Next yeah. week just which aspect of the
game.
And
I presume our friends of the pod will surely let us know
yeah.
on Twitter.
So earlier on, I've been nagging him for ages and he was really good at his time. Earlier on, myself and Fionn managed to get Brandel Chambly on the phone and he was really good with his time. So here's how we got on. Delighted to say that we're joined by a guest who you all know, frankly, through his brilliant work with the Golf Channel. He's the lead analyst there with the Golf Channel. He turned pro in 1985, 6 straight years in the top 100 on the PGA Tour. He beat Payne Stewart to the Vancouver Open in 1998. And the pod wholeheartedly recommends The Anatomy of Greatness, Lessons from the Best Golf Swings in History, which is Brandel Chambly's new book. It's a New York Times bestseller. And Brandel, I'm delighted to say, has made some time for us. You need no introduction here, though. You're amongst golf nerds who are big fans of your work and well aware of your work. You're very welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I always enjoy sitting around talking to people that have a passion for the game like I do. I think some of my fondest moments have been in the company of golf nerds and sitting around having a scotch or two or an Irish whiskey, as it were, and talking about the great swings of the past.
Effectively, you decided to look at all the greatest players in the game and see what was common in their swing, what the commonalities in their swings were.
Yes, yes, that's right. You know, I like every other golf nerd in this world. You sit around and you see, you know, a whole host of golf swings. You know, I mean, there are just as many guys who are laid off as there are across the line, just as many guys as there are cupped at the top as there are shut at the top who made it into the Hall of Fame. So I got to thinking, you know, what are the commonalities? What are the things that they all have in common? Surely they must have something in common that if you're just in general trying to latch onto or to gain some sort of perspective, you could point to. And, you know, I came across many commonalities in the greatest players of all time. And it was very interesting for me. It was, for my entire life, I have studied the game, played the game, thought about the game. But until I sat down to write this book about 2 years ago, I don't think that I really was aware of the commonalities that the greatest players had. But when you actually think about it, there's a universality of the moves that the best players have had. And I recognize that it's changed somewhat, either because of the equipment or the ball or personal preferences. The game has changed somewhat, but I still think that those commonalities are relevant and can be put to good use in this era.
Can you chart how we got here? Generations tend to pass things on. Like, I know you talk about the left heel in the backswing being allowed to raise and a stronger grip than is maybe taught now. I think you pinpoint the 1980s as when instruction started restricting the swing a little bit. Can you give us a sense of how it's evolved over the last 100 years or so?
Yeah, I think, just in general, the whole idea of resistance can sort of find its roots in Ben Hogan's Five Lessons. In that book, he talks about the idea of feeling resistance in the lower body, and that resistance builds a tension, and from that tension comes more speed. Now, he talks about that just in general terms, and Herbert Warren Wind does a great job of writing about it. And then Anthony Ravaglielli, the great illustrator, does a beautiful job of bringing those thoughts to life in his animations. Mm. And it was so well done that it became sort of this idea that began to take hold and take root. And slowly but surely, players who lifted their heel and had a full hip turn were replaced by players who planted their heel and resistance. And then somewhere in the 80s and the early 90s, this idea of it, you know, it was given a name of the X factor. And David Ledbetter began to teach this philosophy, and so many other teachers began to teach this philosophy. Even Butch Harmon talked about maintaining the flex in your right knee and resisting. And, you know, slowly but surely, it pervaded the entire tour. Mm. And while I'll recognize that, you know, there are some very good players who resist with their lower body, I would still argue, and I do argue in my book, that those players would be better off. They would hit it longer, they would hit it higher, and their careers would be better off if they didn't resist. I think that resistance puts undue tension and pressure on their bodies. Mm. And has impoverished this age of golfers to some extent.
Two thoughts on that. One, it's very interesting that Hogan advised that, because it certainly doesn't seem, when you watch him swing, like that's what he actually did. You know, I don't know if he was aware. And two, I think an important point to make for amateurs listening in particular, you're not advocating people sway, which is, you know, like, and that's a key point, because people might be envisaging what you're talking about here as a massive kind of sway away from the ball. That's not the point you're making when you talk about that right leg being braced or not braced.
No, and these are great questions and philosophies that you bring up. You're right. And Hogan did not do the things that he said he did in his book. He always lifted his left heel.
Yeah.
He had a beautiful turn of his hips. You know, I have, throughout my research, I have on a thumb drive every single year that is available of Hogan's golf swing on video from 1937 all the way through to the 80s, I have it. And as long as he could, he lifted his left heel. He also talked about turning the inside of your arm, the front of your arm towards the sky at address, and having that feeling at impact, when in actuality, his elbow pointed at the target, his left elbow pointed at the target at address, and certainly pointed at the target at impact, as all great players did. So there were many things in his book that he may have felt, but he certainly did not do them. And you're right. I'm not proposing, I'm not saying that all the problems are solved just by turning your hips and lifting your left heel. It is somewhat complicated to get the right balance of turning your hips and not either swaying or overturning and tilting to the left. Mm. And I think that those problems can generally be solved with a couple of thoughts. That you keep the weight on the inside part of your right foot, obviously, if you're a right-handed golfer. And that if you feel a little lateral move or bump, is what I call it, it's about 2 inches to the right as you begin your golf swing. And that lateral bump is very important because it does a couple of things. One, it gets the weight to your right side. And two, it keeps the club moving low, and it gives you great width into your backswing and keeps the golf club from cutting to the inside too early in the backswing.
Is that what Stenson's doing at the start of his swing?
Well, I think so. I think if we had Pete Cowan on there, and we were talking to Pete Cowan, he may have some other ideas in mind as to that bump. But whatever his intentions are, the result of that bump is that it keeps the club low and keeps it from cutting to the inside too quickly. And that width, in my estimation, is very important. It establishes a momentum,
yeah,
of which, when you change momentum to the other side, increases the lag in your hands as you transition from backswing to downswing. And of course, that is very important in the game. So, you know, one move begets another, which begets another. They're all sort of build on one another from the time a player, you know, grabs hold of the golf club. So, you know, it's the best players don't really skip any of these moves. And that's what I try to bring about in my book.
Yeah. We're talking to Brandel Chamblee, The Anatomy of Greatness, Lessons from the Best Golf Swings in History, which is his new book, a New York Times bestseller. Like, there's lots of interesting commonalities. We won't have time to touch on them all, clearly. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, I know you'd firsthand experience with that old tilt of the chin or of the head to the right, something Nicholas had and he took from Sam Snead, and there's a lineage to all this, and you'd your own personal experience of even the benefits of something like tilting your head at the start of the swing.
Yes. You know, that is something I recognized, you know, pretty early on in my career. I saw that Hogan's head was tilted to the right in his downswing, and I certainly noticed that in Nicholas. And then I remember playing the tour in the early 90s, and this fellow by the name of, this young kid by the name of Tiger Woods was all the rage. He was coming about, and everybody was prophesizing that he was going to be this great player, and Golf Digest posted, I had never seen him hit a golf shot, and Golf Digest posted his swing, put pictures of his golf swing in their magazine. And about halfway down in the delivery point, he had his head turned to the right. And I just, you don't see that move in very many players. And when I saw that move, when I saw where he was, I thought, you know, game's over. You know, he is going to do things nobody in this game have ever seen before, because he had this perfect body. He had these long limbs and sinewy and this wonderful speed. And then he had all these positions that the game's greatest players have had, which most players today and in that era really didn't. They had sort of missed that nuance. But that lineage, you know, Sam Snead turned his head to the right. Henry Picard did it. And, of course, they all got it from a teacher by the name of Alex Morrison. Way, way back in the 1900s, early 1900s, Alex Morrison put this theory out that if you turned your head to the right going back, it facilitated a greater turn. And if you left your head there as you transition, then it allowed this expanse of your shoulders in transition, this sort of where your left shoulder, again, if you're a right-handed golfer, the left shoulder sort of moves away, the right shoulder, right hip, right knee, it all pauses in transition. That gives you that stretch. And that gave Snead his squat. And that is so important because you can only use your right side once in the golf swing. You can only use it. You can only use that explosive move once. And if you allow for the separation between the left and the right side in transition, then you get that stretch, and then you can get that explosiveness through impact. And it delivers the club on the proper path. So I look for that move in any player coming up, and I see, is it there? And if it's not, generally if it's not, they have a very early kick of their right side, like a Jim Furyk, say, or they've had a short backswing. And if they have a short backswing, then they have to have a very explosive transition, which means they're going to kick their right side in early, and they're probably going to turn their head. Shorter backswings don't have this move, but longer ones do.
What do you think is the main issue with the resistance swing, where you're keeping that lower half so still and solid and you're twisting into it? Is it just that it leads to, you know, knee injuries, lower back injuries, and ultimately a shortened career? Or do you think that there's something else that is problematic with it?
Well, all those things that you mentioned are certainly a concern, big concern. You know, I just think it makes sense. You know, if you're an instructor, and I believe me, I've taken lessons from many, many, many instructors, and they all like it, because if you resist with the lower body, it certainly looks athletic. It's really cool to see somebody who is resisting with the lower body who can still get a full shoulder turn. I mean, that looks very athletic. And it is. You have to be a great athlete to get a full shoulder turn when you resist the lower body. I mean, that just tells you that they have tremendous flexibility. Ricky Fowler does this. Rory McIlroy does this. You know, so many players do this, and you look at it and you think, wow, that is a great athlete. that can resist with the lower body and still get that much turn. But I believe that that impoverishes the golfer because it does put more tension on their lower back. It does give them less time in transition. These athletes, tremendous as they are, would still have a fuller turn still if they didn't have as much resistance. And I'm unlikely to be convinced by anybody telling me that an athlete who is capable of more turn cannot then have bigger benefits in transition of time, of space, and of the ability to build even more power. When I see athletes, great athletes, and I'll use one, say, a Billy Horschel. Billy Horschel is a tremendous athlete, great player. And I say great player in the sense of, you know, he's made it on tour and done things. He's not a great player in the sense that,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
Hall of Fame great. But yeah, he's a fabulous player. But he resists with his lower body. And as good an athlete as he is, as physically impressive that he is, he should probably have a clubhead speed of about 119, 120 miles an hour. But his clubhead speed is only about 113 miles an hour. And if he, in another era, another generation, nobody was as fit as Billy Horschel. Those players were few and far between. But if he did turn more with his lower body and lift his left heel, Billy Horschel would probably have 119, 120, 121 miles an hour clubhead speed. And he would hit the ball, all of the things that gives a player, trajectory, spin, maneuverability, more power out of the rough, all those things would then be at his disposal. And I think this generation, it's my argument that this generation is impoverished because they have become so enamored with this idea.
This generation is also, or certainly on the face of it, is committed to like the most exhausting scientific analysis of the golf swing, both, you know, professionals and the teams that surround them. Why do you think that they are so resistant to challenging the kind of the received wisdom that that the resisted swing, that keeping that lower half so still, isn't necessarily the best way to achieve not just a good swing or a solid swing that works, but longevity in a career?
I'm a big fan of, you know, people think that I'm not a fan of technology. I am. I use TrackMan and all of these forensic gathering devices. I use them every single day in building analysis and in following the numbers to the complete end. I am never not engaged in that. I think that in general, players today are reluctant because their teachers sort of look at me as an enemy to them because I am trying to tell the players not to necessarily give up all of their genius and their talents and their opinions to somebody who's teaching them. I'm trying to tell them, you're the genius. Okay. The person beside you talking to you is not the genius.
Yeah.
You are.
Yeah.
Okay. You're the one painting Mona Lisa. They're just watching.
Yeah.
And they're trying to tell you how to paint the Mona Lisa. I think that we all learn from great achievement by great athletes. And for the most part, those athletes that give us the most, that tell us the most, do so of their own improvisations. They do so of their own ability to create. And I believe in the genius of the athlete. And I don't like it stifled by people who are sitting around and talking to them based upon theories. I've read their theories. I look at their theories. And there's nothing yet that has come about because of TrackMan that has given me any new information. I knew coming steep into the ball that the clubhead was going to the right because every time I hit a punch shot, I would have to aim further and further left my entire career. So I knew if I was coming in steep, the ball was going to the right. People who are TrackMan nuts think this is a revelation, like they discovered Rosetta Stone. And Jack Nicklaus, in his book, talked about when the club was going down, the path was moving to the right. Mm. So that was 40 years ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are no new revelations. Meanwhile, I look at careers and data and players' ability to play over time, and I think that is convincing enough for me.
Mm. And none more so than Nicklaus. Like, I saw an article you wrote recently where you just thought, you made the point, it's strange that nobody is teaching the Jack Nicklaus swing, and this guy was both unbelievably long and unbelievably accurate when it came to driving, did all the things you talk about, lifted that left heel, the right chin, the hips, everything, you know, stronger grip than's commonly thought, all this kind of stuff. And for whatever reason, we've just sort of turned our back on it.
Yes.
How would you sum up what went wrong with Woods?
Well, I think, you know, there are a lot of things at work there. I think that Tiger not only destroyed the greatest body the game had ever seen, he also destroyed the greatest golf swing the game had ever seen. So, you know, that is that's a 1-2 punch that's tough to recover from. Mm. I think, you know, when he was long and sinewy, he had speed, and he traded speed for strength, and he thought that it was a good trade.
Mm.
And it was a very poor trade. You want speed in this game. You know, you don't need to be bulked up. You're not trying to lift something in this game. You're trying to swing something very fast. So he was convinced that speed was a good trade or strength was a good trade for speed. So I think he went wrong there. As it relates to his golf swing, I don't think it's necessarily that he barked up the wrong tree. I think it's that he barked up every tree.
Yeah.
And in barking up every tree, he no longer trusted himself. He no longer trusted his instincts. He turned to other people of decreasing athletic ability. You know, Butch was a good player. Hank was a good player. Sean Foley wasn't quite as good. And Chris Como can hardly play golf at all.
Mm.
So as he went through his teachers, he went to players of decreasing athletic skill, of decreasing accomplishment. And those players were more inclined to believe in very technical thoughts.
Mm.
And it's, you know, it's a generality, certainly. But players who have had very limited success in the game are trying to figure out why they weren't any good. So they, generally speaking, dive into analytical thoughts and technology, trying to figure out reasons why they weren't any good. And so they are far more analytical in their thinking.
Mm.
Now, there's good and bad to that.
Yeah,
I think we've gained a lot of critical thought from people who've dived into the science of the game. But by and large, there needs to be a balance between practical thought and theoretical thought.
Mm.
And Butch Harmon, I thought, was a very great detractor from Tiger's ability, or Tiger's tendency, I should say, to get analytical. And so was Hank Haney. Hank Haney only videotaped Tiger Woods a handful of times. He didn't want him to see his swing on videotape.
Right.
But in general, you know, Tiger went from a very upright swing with very sinewy, quick levers to a flatter swing and a thick, muscular stature.
Mm.
And as he did so, his golf swing got quicker. I'm pretty sure he was damaging his body in the gym, but his golf swing certainly didn't do him any favors, because as he got bigger, he got flatter, and as he got flatter, he got shorter. His golf swing got shorter, and his transition became much, much quicker.
Mm.
And to the degree that he did, he was hurting himself in the gym, and he was hurting himself every time he swung a golf club. And then the coup de grace was him being taught by somebody who believed at that point. Sean Foley doesn't believe this anymore, but at the point when he first started working with Tiger, he believed that you should stay centered over the ball or even have your pressure left.
Yeah, stack and tilt.
And that was the coup de grace. That was the absolute nail in the coffin for Tiger Woods, because it just destroyed his body.
Two last questions then.
Yeah.
We're all huge fans of your punditry. Like, we regularly on the pod will remark that you're the guy we go to. Am I right in saying that there's a point where you became more opinionated, more relaxed about offending people, or even if just giving yeah. your honest opinion. Is that a fair thing, or yeah. am I misjudging?
Yeah, very fair. I would have never, when I played the tour, my caddy used to joke that he could always find me on the range because I would be in the middle of a scrum of people talking. Because I enjoy conversation about the golf swing, and I enjoy people, and I always have. And I love parties and levity and having fun. When I first got into television, I was still speaking as a player, and I did for 2 or 3 or 4 years. And it's a tough transition.
Yeah.
I mean, you're still friends with everybody that's playing the tour, and you still don't want to tiptoe into criticism, you know? And then there was a point where I just, went on TV and I thought, you know, I've done the research. I've done all these thoughts. I'm tired of, not necessarily tired, but I'm just going to speak freely, just about the way the game should be played. And I was looking around and I disagreed with so many of the teachers, and the teachers had such a powerful influence over the players.
Yeah.
If you're a player and you've hired a teacher to work with you and his ideas are doing you harm, you don't always know it as a player. You know, you just don't.
Yeah.
And you are going to go to war over those thoughts because you want to protect your thoughts and your decisions and so forth. But having seen it firsthand, I just, you know, I felt like I should at least try to warn these players that their voice is pretty good and that their talent is something that is rare. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're good enough to play golf at a high level in this game, you are a genius talent. You really are.
Yeah.
And you should protect that talent. You shouldn't just turn it over indiscriminately to somebody else and let them have full opinion over how you should play the game.
Mm.
So, yes, you're right in saying that. Probably about the third or fourth year I was in nice. Television, I changed the way I did TV for sure.
And did you get told off then by guys who came up and said, hey, I thought we were friends, or that's out of line?
Well, I've always said when a player has a criticism or comes up to me and is angry with me, I said, well, you know, first of all, what did I say? And was I wrong? And, you know, I do believe that, you know, there is, you know, tact is important.
Sure.
You know, you ought to be able to say something. I mean, the difference between tact and opinion is you can say one thing without destroying a friendship.
Yeah.
So I am cognizant of that and try to, and I'm always trying to allow for differences of opinion. But I do so much research that by the time I arrive at my opinion, I have looked at every side of it, and I am pretty confident that it is the right opinion.
Yeah.
So I, you know, when you're on TV, you're just making an argument. I'm, you know, you're never not arguing. It's generally civil, but you're making an argument for your opinion. And that's what we're in the business of. You know, if you're on TV, you're in the business of giving your opinion.
Mm.
And I would like to think that I've thought mine out and researched it thoroughly. I don't do research to support my opinions. I discover my opinions when I do research.
Brandel, one of the opinions that definitely generated some controversy, but it seems to have been borne out by events, is if, as you say, that Tiger traded speed for strength by going into the gym, he defended, or it was defended on his behalf by saying he needed to build up the muscle around his knees, etc. Rory McIlroy has done exactly the same thing. He's bulked up in the gym. Now, it has the kind of the nice corollary of making them very presentable and marketable as athletes, because they do look like unbelievably buff. But
yes.
Rory will say, and has been almost like angered to the, in defense and saying, look, I bulk up because I need to protect the muscles of my lower back. It's the only way I'm going to have a long career. I'm going to protect my body in that way. But
yeah.
What's your take on this bulking up fad?
Well, first, I want to say that I'm a huge fan of Rory McIlroy. Huge. I love watching him swing the golf club. and I love listening to him. It is rare when a player comes along with that kind of grace and intellect. It really is. And he's absolutely brilliant in the press room. I love him. I absolutely love him. But, you know, I'm 54 years old, and he's 26 or 7.
Yeah.
You know, I'm speaking more as an elder statesman when I do my commentary and I'm asked to talk about Rory. And so I have said that if you buy into the idea that you have to resist with the lower body, if you buy into that and you do resist with the lower body, then you in effect have less time to build clubhead speed. So if you buy into that idea, and because you now are restricting and you have less time to build clubhead speed, you do need to be more explosive. That word explosive has become part of the vernacular of golf because it's necessary now. Because if you resist, you have less time. So you do need to be explosive, and you do need to go to the gym. You do, because you're now, you've turned the golf swing into an explosive action versus a sort of graceful building of speed. In essence, you're asking somebody to get to full speed in 50 yards, whereas before they had 100 yards. And if I would imagine if we did that, someone's quads would be much, much bigger that needed to get to full speed at 50 yards versus 100. Mm. The longer they race, the leaner they are. So I would agree that you do need to go to the gym. What I would say, though, is that there would not be the need to build the muscle to support the back if they didn't resist with the lower body. Mm. They wouldn't need that because they wouldn't put the pressure on the lower back. You know, when I see Jason Day struggling with his back and Rory struggling with his back, and I see young players, lots of them, Jamie Lovemark is another player that comes to mind, so many of them, Michelle Wee, I am telling these players they're struggling with back issues because they're resisting. And it's not for some mysterious reason.
Yeah.
You know, Ben Hogan, as far as I know, he got hit by a bus and hit more golf balls than any other human being who ever lived. I never, ever read anything about him having a back problem. Mm. Sam Snead, same way. Mm.
Phil Mickelson
had some health issues, but he was still won majors over 24-year span.
Yeah.
And Tom Watson almost won one when he was 60.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would say, yeah, and I agree, there is a corollary to working out. These athletes look great, and they present well, and it's helped them marketability. And I think there's a balance. You know, Gary Player worked out. And
did he?
I would absolutely agree that it created in him an ability and allowed him to sort of offset the physical skills he didn't have that Jack Nicklaus did have.
Yeah.
But he didn't metamorphose his body to the extent that he looked like he was a weightlifter he was, you know, going to play in the NFL. He looked like an athlete. So I think there's a balance, and I think, you know, I've read Rory. I've read about his workout. I know that he is his trainer is McGregor, right? Dr. McGregor? Is that his name?
No, I'm not too sure, but he certainly has one anyway who he values.
Yeah, I've looked at his stuff, but I also look at his clubhead speed, and, you know, I said, and I couched it with as many caveats as I could when I talked and was asked about Rory's workout routine. And, you know, his clubhead speed was sort of declining at the time, and he was, you know, I was just, I didn't want to see Rory go down the same path as Tiger. but I think Rory is training smarter than Tiger trained.
Yeah.
Certainly.
He certainly hasn't bulked up noticeably in the last
2 years.
No, kind of
I think
Rory
looks great.
Yeah.
Rory looks great. And he is a smart kid. And he's got great people around him.
Mm. I half interrupted you there. I was going to say, you know,
yes,
where I first heard you talking like this in the last 2 years, I guess, when you started doing your research, and Phil Mickelson is like a poster boy for everything you're talking about. You know, he ticks many of those boxes.
Oh, beautiful angles.
Beautiful angles and everything. So I guess the last question, because you've been so good with your time. I already know, because, again, you've been talking to a lot of golf nerds listening
honestly, around the world. So again, the book is The Anatomy of Greatness, Lessons from the Best Golf Swings in History. Brandel, what's your final summation to the amateurs listening? Because again, you've made the point repeatedly, these genius players on tour can make anything work. Whereas, you know, amateurs don't even have a tenth or a 20th of the flexibility and physical genius that the pros have. And we're trying to watch them and imitate them. So your message from the greatest swings you've studied to amateurs to finish up on?
Well, I would say that, you know, there were, when I wrote this book, I certainly drew the ire and criticism of most teachers in the United States. And there's some fairly geeky websites about golf. One of them is Golf WRX. And many of those contributors criticized me, but one of them decided to test my theories with TrackMan, with amateurs. So with, you know, players of varying degrees of ability, nowhere near professional level. So, you know, 20 handicappers and whatnot. So he went out and tested the theories in my book with TrackMan to scientifically criticize or laud my book. And he found that the amateurs were better. They hit it higher. They hit it further. They had more clubhead speed. And I, although I hadn't tested it on TrackMan, I had seen throughout my entire life playing the game that amateurs, good amateurs, age well. Those that have, I call it a strong grip, only because weak grips are called neutral.
Yeah.
You know, weak grips where the V's point to your chin, but whether you call it strong or neutral, the V's point to your right shoulder if you're a right-handed golfer. So, you know, growing up, that was a strong grip to me. But, you know, if you get your grip strong where the V's point to your right shoulder and you turn your hips more and you lift your left heel, it doesn't matter your skill level. You will play with less back problems and you will hit the ball further and higher. And you're right, Phil Mickelson, you know, right after I wrote my book and it came out March of last year. And Phil Mickelson in April was in the media center and he said, "I don't know why more people don't swing like me. Mm. I am an absolute testament to the fact that if you have more hip turn and release your lead heel," because he's a lefty, "you release your lead heel, you'll have a longer career." And I had been saying that about Phil for a very long time. And I, you know, I thought it was odd that Phil all of a sudden was using that description of his game. But, you know, I was shaking my head. Yes. Tom Watson was asked on our set this year at the Masters, "Why have you had such great success in your 50s and 60s? And he said that he and Jack Nicklaus had talked about it and that they both agreed it was because they just lifted their left heel. So if you have these types of players, Phil and Tom and Jack, recommending it, well, if it's absolutely essential for the best players in the world to do it, it is no less essential for those who play it recreationally to do it. Matter of fact, it's even more essential, I would argue, that they do it. So it will put more fun in the game, for sure. I've seen it firsthand.
Brandel, such a pleasure talking to you. Keep up the brilliant work, and I've no doubt the listeners are going to go out and dig into this book and read about the great swings in history and what we can learn from them. Again, a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
Likewise. Real pleasure for me as well. I'm big fans of Ireland and all the golf and the golfers and the people from Ireland. So thanks for having me on. It's always a great pleasure.
There we go, Brandel Chamblee there. And I mean, it was great. Even after the phone call, he said, "Really enjoyed it, and give me a call anytime." So we sort of said we might check in with him in 6-7 months and talk about the golfing year. And I dare say every listener right now is going out and lifting their left heel, turning their chin to the right and going for a long, low, high hands. He's a big man for high hands, so not a fan of a flat swing. I dare say a lot of listeners will be suddenly going, "Wow, yeah."
Now, it's good that you make the point to him, is it's not like this sway swing.
No.
It's not about swaying. It's keep staying in the barrel, as they say. But lift your heel. Let that left hip kind of, if you're a right-handed player, let the left hip rise a little.
Yeah. Well, he's saying, make the turn. Instead of having that, where you're
right leg is bent and braced and keeping it like that all the way through. He's saying let that right leg straighten. Don't sway onto the outside of your right foot on the backswing. Keep your weight on the inside of your right foot. But you can just let that right leg straighten. Shane Lowry, funny enough, does it.
Yeah.
And he's all about length in the golf swing. He thinks these short swings and restrained swings are no good, as you've heard. Well, we don't need to repeat what he said.
No.
So, but he was good. I mean, he's a huge Chambly fan. That felt like a real privilege to talk to him.
Dave, what did you think of... So that point I made to him where the idea that like these guys bulking up, you have your Tiger bulking up and you have Rory bulking up and all the controversy over it. But that this idea that there is a corollary, that it does look good in marketing terms, that it makes you a marketable athlete rather than, you know, maybe the slightly out of shape golfer of yore. Like that in order to contend in a commercial sense, like Tiger Woods looked like an athlete.
He looked like the superstar athlete that he was being billed as. And McIlroy's the same. I don't know when the last time I saw like a tubby golfer being given a huge sponsorship deal, but... It's just part of the game now, and that's the look that the kids who are swinging with these, I call them boy band golf swings, they want to actually look and feel that way as well.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
Yeah. Mm. I will never have a fat number one again, even if being lean doesn't help them. Just won't be the way. It's a mindset as much as everything, you know. We're pretty much done, so thanks again to Branal Chambly. I'm sure lots of you will check out the book. Tweet him, actually. Tell him you enjoyed the interview. If you did, you'll get him on Twitter, and he's really interesting on Twitter. He'll throw up interesting pictures and compare modern players with former players and various bits. So he's always good for golf fans. We're done. We will see you next week. Good luck. Tell all my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here in Dardanelle. Little JD starter kid, right?